In fact, this is the seminar of the Quantum Gravity Group, which was moved to fit into the conference. And so we're pleased to have James Hoare with us talking about the gravitational cosmic effect.
Okay, thank you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks for letting me talk to you today. And also thanks for the speakers who came before me. I've learned a lot this week, and I'd like to learn more. But we're going to take a break from triangles and foams for a little while. And I want to talk about some recent work I've done on the gravitational Casimir effect. I actually didn't realize I was going to give this talk during a quantum gravity workshop, so the talk's going to be a bit more geared to a general audience. Okay. So the vacuum space isn't empty, it's teeming with virtual particles. So if you were to put two electrically conducting parallel plates in the vacuum, then the boundary conditions set up by these plates will restrict the modes or the frequencies of the virtual photons that can exist between the plates. Now, outside the plates, there's no such restrictions. And so there's gonna be many more virtual photons outside the plates than in between the plates. And this will cause a pressure difference, which will push the plates together. And this effect is known as the Casimir effect, named after Hendrik Casimir, who discovered it in 1948. Now, more specifically, in quantum field theory, you can quantize fields, and these quantized fields can be, in effect, described as a set of harmonic oscillators with a discrete set of energy levels given by En. Now, in the ground state of this vacuum, the energy is E0, and E0 isn't finite. Sorry, isn't zero, it's finite. So if the sum over all the possible modes is going to give you an infinite energy value. Now this seems to be a problem, but it's argued that it's not the absolute energy value that's the measurable quantity. It's the difference or the change in value that's the physical quantity. So if you take away the energy outside the plates from the energy of the virtual photons in between the plates, then you get a finite value. And you take the derivative of this energy with respect to the plate spacing A, you get the Casimir pressure. And that's a formula I've written up here. And this formula has been experimentally verified. But virtual photons aren't the only virtual particles that contribute to the Casimir effect. In theory, all virtual particles should have some contribution. But particles which have mass act on very short range, and so their contributions are exponentially suppressed. Gravity, however, is massless, and so it's long-ranging. And so in this talk, I'm going to derive the gravitonic contribution to the Casimir effect for real bodies. But you might say gravity couples to matter relatively weakly, so why would you bother calculating the gravitonic contribution to the Casimir effect? Well, in the next section, I'll provide some motivation reasons as to why we want to do this. And then following this, I'll get to the main result or part of this talk, and I'll derive a formula for the gravitational Casimir effect for real bodies. And then I'll use this formula to calculate the gravitational Casimir effect in ordinary materials. And then I'll see what happens when you replace this ordinary material with superconductors. And then finally, I'm going to derive an equation for the non-realistic limit of the generalized Dirac equation in the gravitational wave background. And the reason why I want to do this will be clear in the context of the talk when I get to those later slides. Okay, so now the first reason why I would want to calculate the gravitational Casimir effect rests purely on theoretical grounds. So normally in Casimir calculations, you do one of two things. You either completely ignore the gravitonic contributions, or you go to the other extreme and assume a perfectly idealized reflecting boundary condition. And this is particularly true in the case of cosmological brain world models. And there's nothing in between. So by deriving a formula for the gravitational Casimir effect with real bodies, I'll be filling this theoretical gap. Now, secondly, to get to this equation, I'm going to need to use both general relativity and quantum mechanics. And interesting things seem to happen at this interface. And perhaps the most famous example, which is Hawking radiation. Another lesser known example is the cow experiment. Now, despite its name, it doesn't actually involve a cow. It's named after three authors. Kalela, Overhauser, and Werner. So in their experiments, what they did was they split up a neutron beam in a gravitational field, and and these beams followed two paths. And then the beams recombined. And after recombination, they placed detectors to count the number of neutrons. And they varied the heights of the neutron path by rotating the apparatus. As a function of theta. And I've also have here a picture of the actual apparatus. So the beam splitter were made of plates of silicon crystal. And this is what they found. They found that in the presence of the gravitational field induced a phase shift in the wave function of the neutron particle, such that when the neutron beams were recombined, it caused an interference pattern. And so this was the first experiment which demonstrated simultaneously both a quantum mechanical and gravitational effect. I've written down here the Hamiltonian for the system. Omega is the angular velocity of Earth's rotation. L is the angular momentum of the neutron particle. And I've also distinguished here the gravitational mass and the inertial mass of the neutron particle. Now, it can be shown that the phase shift induced by the gravitational field can be written as a function of the ratio of the gravitational to the inertial mass. Capital K here is just the reciprocal lattice vector of the crystal silicon plates, and T is the time of flight between points A and B, and T prime is the time of flight between points A and C. And the point of this equation is that it also shows that the cow experiment was also the first test for the violation of the weak equivalence principle in the quantum mechanical system. Because if you recall, the weak equivalence principle, or WEP, says that the gravitational mass should equal the inertial mass. But why should we think that WEP is violating the quantum mechanical system? Well, for example, many quantum gravity theories predict or assume some sort of WEP violation at some level. And the search for WEP violation is actually a serious business. And I found this this chart here of all the WEP violation experiments over the years. The red arrow represents experiments involving only classical systems. And the black arrow represents tests which involve at least one quantum mechanical system. An equivalent statement of the weak equivalence principle is that two test bodies falling in a gravitational field will accelerate at the same rate. So the EVOS ratio is a measure of this. The EVOS ratio measures the difference in the acceleration of these two test particles. So if WEP isn't violated, then the EVOS ratio should be exactly equal to zero. And plotted here is the EVOS ratio. So you can see in this chart, the cow experiment tested for a violation of the weak equivalence principle to the order of accuracy of 10^-3, finding no violation. And over the years, this experiment has been increased in accuracy to 10^-8, also finding no violation. But if WEP is to be violated in a quantum mechanical system, you'd expect it to be violated at a much higher order of accuracy. And so there have been proposals for space-bound experiments to test WEP violation in classical and quantum mechanical systems to the order of 10^-15 over the next couple of decades. Okay. I've got a problem with my computer. Okay, so using this theoretically speculated violation of a WEP in quantum mechanical system, there have been a number of proposals over the years of how you could use this to create an effective enhanced gravitational interaction. So here's a list of some of these ideas. I'm going to revisit one of them later. But if there exists a way to create an effective enhanced gravitational interaction, then the gravitational Casimir effect may be a measurable quantity. And this forms the third and final reason as to why we'd want to calculate it. Okay, so to derive the gravitational Casimir effect, I'm going to start with the gravito-electromagnetic formalism of the Einstein field equations. E and B are components of the Weyl tensor, and J you can think of as being like a matter current. Now, the important thing here is that this formalism very much resembles the Maxwell's equations. And I'll be using this analogy to guide me through the derivation. Okay, so now I want to calculate the energy of the virtual gravitons in between the plates. So if you look at the geometry of the system, then by its symmetry, the components of the allowed modes, which are perpendicular to the plates, will form a discrete set. And so you sum over all of these modes. Whereas the component which are parallel to the plates will remain continuous. And so you integrate over this. And next you apply Stokes' theorem to get the boundary conditions. And this was originally found by Ingram in 97. Here, chi is the gravitational susceptibility. And ETT is the gravitoelectric, the traceless tangential components of the gravitoelectric field, and BTT is the traceless tangential component of the gravitomagnetic field. Oh, and delta here means a change in quantity across the interface. Yes?
So what's the gravitational equivalent of the plates being conducted? Because the important point of the Casimir effect is that the electromagnetic force is shielded by the conductivity of the plates.
So
now, there's no way to shield gravitational attraction unless you have negative energy density.
Okay, so I can answer the first part. So the equivalent of the electric conductivity is the so-called gravitational conductivity, which will be on a slide later. Okay. But this is not important for this point. It's just the presence of the plates will have an effect on the gravitational field. But as you'll see, it's not a very strong effect. It's virtually transparent, right, as you would expect. It's because of the coupling, gravitational coupling is very weak, yes. The gravitational susceptibility is something I will define later. Yep. So just think of it as an analog of the electric susceptibility, but I haven't defined it yet. It's just some.
But
some number at the moment. I've also written down here ETT and BTT. So let me explain this. Alpha here is the maximum amplitude of the plus polarization of the gravitational wave, and beta is the maximum amplitude of the cross polarization of the gravitational wave. The other components like gamma and stuff are defined here. It's just the angle. Okay. So if we apply this boundary condition to ETT and BTT, we'll get a set of simultaneous equations. Okay. Oh, it's getting dry. Okay. All right, so for example, if we apply, if we look at the left interface, then the boundary conditions there for ETT will get you the first equation. And for BTT, it'll get you the third equation. And similarly, look at the right-hand side, the right interface. ETT will get you that, and BTT will get you that. Here, alpha is the incident component of the gravitational wave. Alpha prime is the transmitter component, and alpha double prime is the reflector component on the left-hand side. And what else do I want to say here? Okay, so now you can write this in matrix form. And if you write this in matrix form, you can calculate its determinant. And determinant equals that. And we know that there's a solution if the determinant is equal to zero. And if we do this, it allows us to do a clever thing. It allows us to use the argument principle of complex analysis. To calculate the sum of all the modes, all the allowed modes. And the argument principle says that the sum of all the modes that are zeros of delta is given by this equation. And so we can plug this equation into our energy equation to get the energy of all the allowed modes of the virtual gravitons in between the plates. But of course, this will give us infinite value. So we need to take away the energy at infinite plate separation. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Pardon? Oh, okay, sorry. So this is an integral over the imaginary axis, and this is an integral over a radius around the complex plane, and you take this radius to an infinity. So it's so this is the imaginary plane. Then you take the integral over here, and you go clockwise around, and then you take this to r goes to infinity. That's what that equation does. Yep. Okay. So if you do this and then integrate by parts, you eventually get, after a bit of fiddling around, this formula, which is the gravitational kinetic energy for real bodies. And this is the main result of this talk. So what are these R plus and R cross coefficients? Well, if we look at, say, for example, again, the left interface and the boundary conditions and the equations which is set up to satisfy the boundary conditions. As you recall, we get these two equations. Now, instead, this time, if we solve for alpha, we see that the magnitude of the ratio of alpha double prime to alpha is exactly equal to R plus. And if you recall that alpha double prime is the reflected component, and alpha is the incident component, then we see that R plus is the gravitational analog of the Fresnel coefficient for the plus polarization of the gravitational wave. Oh, and similarly, if we do it for beta, we see that R plus is the gravitational analog of the Fresnel coefficient for the cross polarization of the gravitational wave. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to use our derived formula to calculate the gravitational Casimir effect in a thin film made of ordinary materials. But to do that, I need a value for chi. And this is where the gravitational susceptibility becomes important. So to get a value for chi, I'm going to use a result derived by Peters in 74, who derived the gravitational refractive index. And the way that he did this was he considered a thin film of a free particle model, and he looked at the scattering of a gravitational wave on an individual particle, and then he summed over the combined effect of scattering of all the particles. And after he did that and some maths, blah blah blah, he got this formula. And so chi is related to n through this. So now we have an expression for chi. And we can plug this into our formula to calculate the gravitational Casimir energy. But in Casimir experiments, the energy isn't normally directly measured. It's the pressure that's measured. And so to get the gravitational Casimir pressure, we need to take the derivative of our formula with respect to plate separation, A. Okay. And so now, to complete our calculation, we're going to need a density. And I'm going to assume a typical density of 10 to the 4 kilograms per meters cubed. And using this density, I calculate that the gravitational Casimir pressure in a thin film of ordinary material at 1 micrometer separation is on the order of 10 to the minus 21 nanopascals. And you consider that in typical Casimir experiments, the Casimir pressure that they measure is on the order of nanopascals. This is a very small value, well beyond detection. So essentially, it's essentially transparent. Right. To get a value which is measurable, you're going to need a density on the order of 10 to the 27 kilograms per meters cubed. And this is utterly unachievable, I mean, at least terrestrially. So up to now, I've only looked at ordinary material. So the question now is, what happens if we replace it with a superconductor? And I ask this question because in a paper written by Minter, Victor McNally and Chiao in 2010, they propose that superconductors could be used to create an effective enhanced gravitational interaction. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to present their argument, and then I'm going to provide somewhat of a critique of it. Okay, so this is their argument. They say that when a gravitational wave hits a superconductor, the delocalized Cooper pairs of the superconductor will behave differently from the localized ion cores of the superconductor. So in particular, they say that if a gravitational wave at a frequency below the BCS gap frequency hits the Cooper pair, to first order, it will not change its ground state, and therefore its momentum will not change. Whereas the ion cores will follow the geodesic path provided by the gravitational wave. And because the ion core is positive and the Cooper pair is negative, this will cause a separation in charge and therefore set up an internal electric field. Okay, and I've taken this diagram from the paper which illustrates this. And this internal electric field shows up in the Hamiltonian as a term QA. Where Q is the electron charge. H here is the gravitational vector potential. And they use this Hamiltonian to calculate the mass current. And because of the presence of this, this large QA term, the mass current is effectively enhanced. And because you have a large mass current, you have a large mass conductivity. And just like the electromagnetic case, if you have a large mass conductivity, or in the electromagnetic case, if you have a large electric conductivity, the electromagnetic wave gets reflected. Analogously, if you have a large mass conductivity, then the gravitational wave can be reflected. And they call this effect the Heisenberg-Coulomb effect, because underlying the idea is the uncertainty principle, which sets up a Coulomb force. Okay. Now, the problem I have with this argument can be seen in this equation. So let me repeat what they said. They said that if a gravitational wave at a frequency below the BCF frequency hits the Cooper pair, it will not change its ground state to first order, and therefore its momentum will not change to remain zero. And so they set this term here to zero. But the BCS gap frequency is the amount of energy required to break up the Cupid pair. It doesn't say anything about its momentum. So you can't really just set it to zero. Instead, what I believe should happen, or actually happens, is that the Cupid pairs move along with the ion cores. Now, if it moves in exactly the same way as the ion core, in other words, if WEP isn't violated, then there'll be no separation of charges and no internal electric field, and hence no gravitational wave reflection. But if WEP is violated, then it'll move differently than the ion cores, and there'll be a separation of charges and hence an internal electric field, and hence some gravitational wave reflection. But I don't think it's going to be on the order of magnitude that they propose, where the Cooper pairs do not move at all. But nevertheless, using their argument, they were able to write down a gravitational reflection coefficient. Here, delta is the skin depth, and D is the film thickness. And psi here is the imaginary frequency, which is the frequency times imaginary I. So importantly for us, we can use our derived formula to calculate the gravitational Casimir pressure according to the Heisenberg-Coulomb effect, and therefore provide a means in which to test this conjecture. So I've written down here also the electromagnetic reflection coefficient. Lambda is the coherence length of the superconductor. And so if we use these two reflection coefficients and our derived formula for the gravitational Casimir effect and the standard electromagnetic Casimir effect formula, then we can calculate the gravitonic and photonic contribution to the Casimir effect. Okay, and this is what I've done here. So what this shows is, if the Heisenberg-Coulomb effect is correct as Minter et al. Claims, then the gravitonic contribution is going to be an order of magnitude larger than the photonic contribution. And this could easily be tested in an experiment. So you'll conduct your Casimir experiment with a superconductor and see if this effect is real. Personally, I don't think you'll see such a large effect. I think if the HG conjecture is correct, I think it's going to be of a smaller magnitude. But I still think the experiment should be conducted, but probably only after a more theoretically rigorous development of the conjecture has been developed. And the reason that I think it should still be conducted is because, firstly, it's a relatively easy experiment to conduct. And secondly, if the HG effect is found to be real, even if it's small, it will have a large impact on physics. So if you conducted the experiment above the superconducting temperature, And you found that the Casimir pressure could be attributed to a photonic contribution alone. And then you lower the temperature into the superconducting regime, and suddenly you find that the Casimir pressure cannot be attributed to a photonic contribution alone. Then I think this would be good evidence for the HC effect. And this would have, this would be a major discovery, because this would be the first evidence for gravitons, and also the first violation of WEP in a quantum mechanical system, or in any system. And if you found no such effect, I think this is also a worthwhile result, because it would place limits on WEP violation in a quantum mechanical system. Okay, so another problem I have with their derivation was this Hamiltonian that they use. And this is what I'm going to visit in the next section. And this is the final section. Okay, so this part of the talk I actually only wrote last night after the banquet, so there's probably going to be typos. But anyway, okay, so let me go back to the previous slide. So this Hamiltonian here was originally used by DeWitt in 1966 in a paper where he looked at the behavior of electrons in a superconductor in a gravitational field. And the gravitational field that he used was a static one. So my problem is that I'm not totally convinced that you can use the same Hamiltonian for a gravitational wave background. To get the correct Hamiltonian in a gravitational wave background, you have to start with the generalized Dirac equation in curved space-time, and then take its non-relativistic limit. And this is actually what I did as part of another unrelated problem, and this is what I'm going to talk about in this section. So up here, I've written down the generalized Dirac equation in curved space-time. And here I've written down the metric for a singly polarized gravitational wave. F is just some wave function which describes a wave propagating in the x direction. So if we use this metric, we can write down the Dirac equation in the familiar Schrodinger form here. These gammas are just your standard Dirac gamma matrices. Okay. Now there's a systematic way in which to get the non-relativistic limits of the Dirac equation with relativistic correction, and this method is known as the Faulty-Valhoeven transformation. Now, the Faulty-Valhoeven transformation, or the FW transformation, presents a very useful representation, because it splits up the upper and lower spinner components. Now, in the non-relativistic limit, we aren't interested in the mixing of the upper and lower spinner components, because in the low energy regime, an electron isn't going to suddenly turn to a positron and vice versa. Furthermore, another use thing about the FW transformation is that it produces a form which is highly amenable to interpretations with analog classical quantities. Okay. Now, typically there are two types of FW transformation. One is known as the standard FW transformation. And it's called the standard, I think, just because it came first. The other one is called the exact FW transformation. But let me start by explaining the standard FW transformation. Okay, so to do this, I need to first define the what is known as the odd part of the Hamiltonian. The odd part of the Hamiltonian contains only terms involving alpha matrices. And the even part of the Hamiltonian chain contained terms only involving the beta matrices. So the alpha matrices mixes the upper and lower spinor components. The beta matrix is diagonal, and so it doesn't mix the upper and lower components. So in O here, which is the odd part of the Hamiltonian, I've taken away beta components, and in E, which is even a part of the Hamiltonian, I've taken away the odd components. Okay. Let me be more explicit. Okay, so I've got O is equal to H beta. Okay, so if you go back to the previous slide, you can sort of see H is something like this, some alpha matrix, and it has some beta matrix. And now if you apply this transformation, you get alpha G minus beta, alpha G beta minus beta squared m beta. So now we need to use identities. We know that beta squared is equal to 1, and we also know that these guys don't commute, so alpha beta is equal to minus beta alpha. And so therefore, this is equal to half alpha g. So I'm swapping this around, and then beta squared, that becomes, I've done something wrong here. If I swap that around, it becomes beta squared, okay, alpha g. And then you got, I forgot the h, the g, plus beta m minus alpha g. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Maybe I'll use that board.
You have it on the slide anyway.
I don't really have it on the slide. No, I don't. Yeah, okay. Okay. Well, just can you see that how this removes the beta component, this removes the alpha component? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Now I won't bother going through it. Okay. Now what do I want to say? Okay. So the standard FW transformation is a unitary transformation given by E to the IS, where S is defined there. And if we apply this unitary transformation and then do a perturbative expansion, you'll see that the first commutation term will produce to first order a minus zero term. So this minus zero term will remove the odd parts of the Hamiltonian. But there will also be higher order terms, which in general can involve alpha terms, which we'll need to get rid of. And so to do this, you first write down H prime to your desired order of accuracy, and then you repeat this process iteratively. That is, H prime now becomes H, and H double prime becomes H prime. And you run through this process again to remove the higher order alpha terms. And you keep doing this until all the alpha terms are removed to your desired order of accuracy. Okay, the other method is the exact FW transformation. The exact FW transformation only works if your Hamiltonian anticommutes with J, where J is defined there. So if your Hamiltonian has this property, then you can apply the exact FW unitary transformation, which I've written up here, to separate your Hamiltonian into even and odd terms. Now, the exact FW transformation is so called because, unlike the standard FW transformation, it doesn't involve a perturbative expansion. In other words, it's exact. But in practice, to write down an expression for the square root of h squared, you're going to need to take some sort of perturbative series anyway. Oh, but a big advantage of the exact FW transformation is that its calculation is much more simple than the standard FW transformation, which requires an iterative approach. The drawback, of course, is it doesn't work for all Hamiltonians, only ones which satisfy this condition. But luckily for us, our Hamiltonian does satisfy the exact FW condition. So I'm going to do the calculation here. So another piece of work, I used the exact FW transformation to get the non-realistic limit of the generalized Dirac equation in a gravitational background. And that Hamiltonian I've written down here. And as a check, I also calculated using the more tedious standard FW transformation. And using both methods, I arrived at the same Hamiltonian. Now, the thing I want to point out is that even if we ignore the spin terms, which are the high order terms, the FW transformation shows that the Hamiltonian used by Minter et al. Isn't the correct non-realistic limit of the Dirac equation in a gravitational wave background. So in future work, if we wanted to derive or calculate more theoretically rigorous developments of the HG conjecture, you would at the very least need to use the correct Hamiltonian. And I think I'll end the talk there. Thank you.
Before starting the questions, what is T?
Oh, T was defined previously. It's a diagonal matrix. Yeah.
Where is the gravitational? Oh, it's in A.
No, A is a magnetic. The gravitational part is here.
Oh, F.
F, yeah.
So T is just the gravitational.
Yeah.
So do I understand correctly that you need to have the violation of the weak energy principle in order to have the gravitation cosmic?
Yeah, violation of the weak energy principle, yes, correct.
Oh, okay.
Correct. So that's an underlying assumption. Without it, yeah, as well.
No, you can need the violation of the weak in order to have what?
Okay, so this was spoken before you came in, but there was this conjecture called the HC conjecture, which says that if the weak equivalent principle is violated in a quantum mechanical system, in this case, in the delocalized cubic pairs of a superconductor, then this can create an effective enhanced gravitational interaction through some arguments which I took a little while to explain. And if the weak equivalent principle isn't violated, then the whole conjecture falls down. So it's based on that assumption.
Plot, and if I understand correctly, that was also
Fourier's form. Yes, correct.
So can you
So I'll point out two things which are wrong. First, remember I said their assumption that the momentum goes to zero, I believe is wrong. Secondly, they used the wrong Hamiltonian. I think they used Hamiltonian, which is only valid for static gravitational fields. But that's just two things that you need to change. It's actually a very difficult conjecture to prove rigorously. So it hasn't been done yet.
But in this plot, it seems that the gravitational effect was even bigger than the computer.
Yes, correct. Using their heuristic arguments, which I think leads what to be desired.
That should change?
I don't know. So first of all, if WEP is not violated, then gone, nothing there. If WEP is violated, I think the HE effect is real, but I think it's small. I mean, how small, I don't know. It could be so small that you can just forget about it. But it could be small, but maybe measurable, then that would be something else.
Using your Hamiltonian?
Yeah, okay, sure. You can use this Hamiltonian and go through the arguments, but there's still gaps in their arguments which are heuristic. And this will probably change the number, but I suspect not too much. Because the big argument is they say that the momentum does not change at all, and I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong.
Yeah. And what you see is the Dirac equation on the gravitational wave background. Why does one think that this is the correct description of the energy? Because if you're thinking of gravitons, they're not gravitational waves. They're quantum excitations, which we think only in some large limit become gravitational waves, in particular classical background. Mm-hmm. Second of all, shouldn't there be some kind of back reaction between the matter degrees of freedom and the gravitational
degrees? So forget about gravitons. You think about just photons. To calculate the photonic contribution, you go through a very similar process. This is what people have done. They mix classical concepts with quantum mechanical concepts. It's derived at the Casimir formula.
Difference is that electromagnetism is linear. It's linear.
Gravitational waves are also linear.
Because it's linearized.
Pardon? Anyway. Yeah, but this is linear. This is not in a strong gravitational wave background. It's in flat space with perturbations. Mm-hmm. So that's also linear. And I think it's okay to use the same arguments as photonic case.
Okay, so what about the back reaction?
Back reaction.
This is like the Pauli equation for an electron in an external magnetic field.
So in electromagnetism, this would be using slightly charged, oppositely charged plates. That would also create
that. If you use charge by instead of...
You have a mass, right, that corresponds to charge. In gravity, so if you have electrodynamic Casimir effect, you could charge the plates and then get the same kind of back reaction, bending into plates.
Charge plates. Would the back reaction no longer make it linear? Would it be a non-linear problem then?
You could put it in an external gravitational field, which is produced by the waves.
No, I'm just confused because here the gravitational waves are used as background. So they're not dynamical. Instead of using them as well, quantum excitations, which have some energy and which, probably should interact with the A field or something.
You should remember that we're talking about virtual gravitons here. There actually is no real gravitational wave. These are just fluctuations of the vacuum, which causes the Casimir effect.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there should still be Feynman rules for those. Okay.
But this,
it's okay whether one can.
But this part was for the for how the gravitational wave interacts with the electron or with the matter.
Yeah, this equation was this equation is the Dirac equation.
Yes. And there's a separate part which is the gravitational wave.
Yeah. This is for the superconducting.
Yes. This is to answer your question. I mean, this is to answer how can you not have kinetic energy to see them, to see them.
Okay. So, if there isn't any further question.
So, should we wait for this effect to be there?
Actually, okay, that's a good question. After I published this, right, I had a few experimentalists call me up or get in contact with me and ask me about it. They were very excited about it because they saw that graph, the one I showed you. But I don't think they didn't read the fine print. In the fine print, I mentioned a couple of times that the theory was speculative and I needed more convincing. And so when I told them this and I explained why, I think they lost some enthusiasm. I think don't hold your breath. I mean, it's an easy experiment to conduct, but I don't want to waste their time if the theory isn't rigorous yet. But if someone wants to test it, I think it's worthwhile. It's an easy experiment, relatively. I mean, from a theorist's point of view, it's easy.
Here for the discussion session. And so let's thank James again.